Hello and welcome to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, July 26th, 2026. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We always begin the second hour by reading the names in the obituaries. Today's list includes the following names: Judith Allen Gishweis, Roman Berezinski, Norma Chrisman Stoiken, Jeannie Foster, Midge Galst Golner, William Redmond Gruel, Philip Hagerty, Nancy Kivett, Carl Kunasek, John Peterson, Lynn Warder, and Kent Worley. Sun Sounds of Arizona extends its condolences to the families and friends of the people listed in today's obituaries. And now we'll turn to the page of the paper known as the Arizona Economy section. It looks like there's two articles on this page. The first one is Forging Strong Leaders Requires a Plan. It's written by Alicia Hull as a special for the USA Today. In today's job market, the challenge for managers is not just hiring talent. It's figuring out how to keep people growing once they are inside a company. But as employees lean toward job security and stability, developing leaders has become complicated. And that shift is pushing more organizations to think differently about how to build leadership from within. One common approach is a leadership pipeline, or internal succession plan, which helps managers spot high-potential employees and start preparing them for bigger roles over time. The idea is not just to fill roles faster, it's to make sure that growth inside a company is intentional and consistent. Such pipelines can improve retention, lower hiring costs, and make teams more stable. They also reduce the risk of a bad hire, since internal employees already know the culture and how things actually work day to day. It seems like a win-win, but building a pipeline that works takes more than just promoting the best performers. It takes strategy. A leadership pipeline is a workplace succession strategy where managers identify employees with high potential and start preparing them for future leadership roles. Rather than waiting for a position to open up, leaders think about who could grow into certain roles. For employees, it can make career growth feel less uncertain. When managers are actively thinking about future roles, it's easier for people to see how their current work connects to where they could go next. As Amy Garifas, who is the chief people officer at Zip Recruiter, explained, quote, "You've already onboarded them. You've already gone through the hiring process. They know the players. They have their internal network. They know the business. Giving them that lever to grow their career within the company is a huge retention factor. They don't have to go elsewhere to seek opportunity. They see it right in front of them," unquote. And for managers, it can mean looking inward first instead of immediately turning to external hires. Leadership planning should always be something that managers are thinking of, Garifas said. There's no perfect moment to start building a leadership pipeline, but waiting until a role opens up is usually too late. While succession planning and training can be scheduled throughout the year, leaders should continuously be thinking about what roles may need to be filled in the next 6 to 12 months. That ongoing approach helps take the guesswork out of promotions. Instead of reacting when a gap appears, managers can be intentional about who to promote, when to promote them, and how to prepare employees for future opportunities. Before an employee can become a leader at a company, They have to feel supported in their current role. They have to want to stay. And they need opportunities to build leadership skills before a promotion is available. Anthony Bellucia, an organizational psychologist, said that one of the biggest mistakes that managers make is waiting until employees are ready to leave before trying to make them stay. Exit interviews are like an autopsy at the end. What went wrong and how could we have kept you? But stay interviews are preventative medicine because you can catch issues before you lose good employees. That was a quote from Bellucia. He also added that stay interviews can be insanely simple, centered on three core questions. What makes you stay? What would make you leave? And what would you change tomorrow? By having these ongoing conversations, managers can see where employees need extra support and where they would like to go next. It shows that they are invested in employee growth. Managers should also create opportunities for employees to build leadership skills before a promotion is on the table. One of the most effective ways to develop leaders is by giving them chances to practice leadership before they officially have the title. Garifas explained and said, quote, "It's not just identifying what those opportunities are, but it is pushing and stretching your employees to make sure they understand why you are putting opportunities in front of them." Unquote. And that could mean leading a project, taking on a stretch assignment, mentoring a newer employee, or working with another department. Managers may also need to rethink what leadership potential actually looks like. While many companies gravitate toward employees who are outspoken or dominant or quick to take charge, those traits do not always translate into effective leadership. Bellucia said, quote, "I too often see people judge somebody's future leadership potential based on dominance. Are they loud? Are they aggressive? Do they seem decisive enough to lead?" Unquote. Now, while these might make up some leadership traits, they are not the only ones to consider. Instead, he said, managers should broaden how they evaluate potential. Bellucia said, quote, "It's important to look at collaboration, curiosity, resilience, and the ability to be a good team member." Unquote. That broader view helps managers avoid two common mistakes: promoting someone who doesn't actually want to move into leadership, or overlooking quieter employees who may be strong future leaders. Even the best leadership pipeline depends upon one thing: employees who are willing to step into new opportunities. And not everyone wants to be promoted. And that has become more complicated in today's job market. According to a 2025 Gallup report, employee engagement in the United States has fallen to its lowest level in more than a decade, with fewer workers reporting strong connections to their roles, teams, or company mission. And that lower engagement, Bellucia noted, is feeding into a broader trend of employees becoming more risk-averse and less interested in traditional advancement. For some employees, becoming a leader may feel less appealing than maintaining what they know and what feels stable. Bellucia said, quote, "A lot of people are just trying to keep their roles. Managers may need to shift how they are managing, thinking about things like recognition, transparency, and predictability, as opposed to stretch goals." Unquote. And that was the article, "Forging Strong Leaders Requires a Plan." Our second article from the Economy page is entitled "Perfect Storm Driving Up Produce Prices," written by Elizabeth Canales from the Mississippi State University newspaper called The Conversation. From tomatoes and berries to lettuce and peppers, shoppers are feeling sticker shock in the produce aisle. Recent headlines have focused in particular on soaring tomato prices. They spiked by roughly one-fifth from June 2025 to June 2026. That's according to consumer price data published by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. But across the board, fruits and vegetables have gotten more expensive. Lettuce prices jumped by about 32% during that same 12-month period, while prices for all fresh vegetables increased about 10%. Fresh fruit saw smaller hikes. Apples were only up 7%, and citrus fruit prices just rising 6%. As an agricultural economist, I see a complex mix of factors at work. Extreme weather, worker shortages, rising labor costs, high energy and shipping prices, as well as fallout from the Trump administration's trade policies, just to name a few. And because some of these inflation drivers affect multiple sectors, costs are now building up throughout the supply chain. The breadth of these factors suggests that widespread relief may not come quickly. But inflation-weary shoppers can still take some steps to ease the sting of high prices. To start with, weather disruptions have cut supply and pushed prices up. Unusual freezes in Florida in early 2026, for example, hit a variety of crops, including citrus, strawberries, blueberries, tomatoes, and sweet corn, which led to losses of yield and higher prices. Imports also play a critical role in the U.S. food supply, especially during the winter and early spring months when domestic production is limited. And if adverse weather conditions coincide with changes in trade policy, as is the case with the U.S.-Mexico relationship, produce supply and prices are especially affected. The surge in tomato prices is a good example. To protect the domestic tomato industry, the Commerce Department withdrew in June 2025 from a deal with Mexico, which was known formally as the U.S.-Mexico Tomato Suspension Agreement, in order to end duty-free access for Mexican tomatoes. This move effectively imposed a 17% anti-dumping duty on most tomato imports. So with imports accounting for about three-quarters of the U.S. tomato supply, and Mexico supplying the overwhelming majority of foreign-grown tomatoes, U.S. consumers ultimately picked up the tab. In addition, reports suggest that Mexican tomato production declined after the agreement ended, with tomato imports dropping by 13% year over year, and that diminished supply likely pushed prices higher. Growing everything from strawberries to collard greens is labor-intensive, and for many years, worker shortages have compelled farms to hike wages. Amid those pressures, producers are reporting that having to pay more for labor is adding to their own rising production cost. Another factor is fertilizer prices, which have spiked due to disruptions caused by the Iran war. This geopolitical shock has affected the flow of goods, including fertilizer and oil passing through the Strait of Hormuz, hiking prices, and fueling volatility in global fertilizer markets. Fertilizer prices paid to manufacturers jumped by more than 20% year over year in June 2026, while nitrogen fertilizer prices increased a whopping 46%, according to U.S. government data. So with all those factors driving up cost, farmers have little control over the prices they receive for their products. Market prices are largely determined by the forces of demand and supply, and that includes domestic production and imports. And considering the producer costs account for only about one-third of the retail price for fresh produce, those increases are not always fully passed through to consumers. Beyond production cost, higher fuel prices have made doing business throughout the supply chain more expensive. The Iran war has resulted in a significant spike in fuel prices, roughly 27% over the year, and that trickles down through the economy. The jump has a pronounced effect on refrigerated truck rates, which are critical for shipping fresh produce. Those were 20% higher in June of 2026 compared to a year earlier, according to data from the Department of Agriculture. So what can shoppers do? Well, food inflation delivers a major hit on consumer budgets, particularly for low-income Americans who are more sensitive to price increases. When the quality of diet in vulnerable households drops, rising food cost may be among the contributing reasons. A May survey of shoppers illustrates this financial squeeze. 1 in 3 households report a drop in fresh produce purchases as a result. But there are still workarounds if you are seeking affordable yet healthy options. For example, certain types of produce and legumes have been less affected by inflation. Bananas, oranges, potatoes, dried beans, peas, and lentils. Shoppers should also look to canned and frozen fruit and vegetables to save money. They're just as healthy, but less affected by inflation, because their longer shelf life means that factors like weather and transportation play less of a role. Prices for processed produce increased year over year by just 3% and increased by 2.4% for frozen. This substitution for cheaper alternatives is already evident in consumer choices, as 1 in 5 shoppers have reported shifting from fresh to frozen produce. With so many factors contributing to higher inflation, some of the challenges affecting produce prices may be too long-lasting and hard to resolve overnight. So as a result, relief at the checkout line may take longer than many consumers would like. And that was the article, Perfect Storm Driving Up Produce Prices. And there's a note here at the bottom of the article. It says, "The Conversation is an independent and nonprofit source of news, analysis, and commentary from academic experts. The Conversation is wholly responsible for the content." And those were the two articles from the Arizona Economy page. So, coming up on 18 minutes past the hour, we're going to move on over to the sports page now. From the front page of the sports section, it's all about Arizona Cardinals football. And it's entitled, Clocking In, Job Battles, More Games, Joint Practices, Part of Busy Summer. Written by Theo Mackey for the Arizona Republic. When the Arizona Cardinals reported a training camp on Wednesday, July 22nd, it still felt as if their season opener existed in a different orbit. 52 days, after all, separated the Cardinals' first practice from their Week 1 matchup against the Los Angeles Chargers at SoFi Stadium in Los Angeles. Well, that's a lot of time, and it's a crucial period for a new head coach, Mike LaFleur, to build the foundation for what he hopes will be the next winning generation of Cardinals football. So, what do the next 7 weeks actually include? Here is an overview of the schedule and what the Cardinals will aim to accomplish. Training camp. The Cardinals arrived at training camp on Wednesday with their first practice session 1 day later. That began nearly 3 weeks of practices at State Farm Stadium, 8 of which are open to the public. This is perhaps the most important stretch of the off-season for LaFleur and his staff. The Cardinals installed their new offense, as well as some tweaks to Nick Rollis' defense during spring practices. But training camp is the first opportunity to run those plays at full speed with pads on. It's when they will learn what works and what doesn't. It's when they will be able to practice new techniques at something resembling game speed. And it's when players will stake a claim to starting jobs and roster spots. Training camp at State Farm Stadium will conclude on August 11th, with the final public session being the red and white practice on August 9th. After a trip to Las Vegas to face the Raiders on August 13th, The Cardinals will move operations to their Tempe training facility. Because they play in the Hall of Fame game on August 6th, the Cardinals were permitted to start training camp a week early. There was minimal advantage over the rest of their division, though, as each of their three NFC West foes also had exemptions to start training camp early due to their Week 1 schedules. So, for the preseason, the Cardinals' preseason schedule looks like this. August 6th, Cardinals versus Panthers in Canton, Ohio. August 13th, the Cardinals at the Raiders in Las Vegas. August 22nd, the Cowboys at the Cardinals in Glendale. August 28th, the Cardinals at the Packers in Green Bay, Wisconsin. It remains to be seen to what extent the Cardinals will play their starters in preseason games. LaFleur arrives in Arizona after three seasons with the Rams, who almost never play important players during the preseason. But the Rams are an annual Super Bowl contender, filled with veterans, for whom health is paramount. The Cardinals might take a different approach as they prioritize player development. The Hall of Fame game typically features players that are vying for roster spots, while the preseason finale in Green Bay comes 2 days after a joint practice. That means the Raiders and the Cowboy games are the most likely opportunities for LaFleur to test his starters in game situations. But each game, though, is crucial for players that are on the roster bubble. And then we've got a joint practice. The Cardinals are set to hold one joint practice this summer, facing off against the Packers in Green Bay on August 26th. Now, these sessions have become increasingly popular in recent years. Coaches view them as an opportunity for key players to get full-speed reps with a reduced injury risk compared with the less controlled setting of a preseason game. And as such, they're also an opportunity to learn about the Cardinals' capabilities. Last year, Kyler Murray and Marvin Harrison Jr. struggled in a joint practice with the Broncos. The defense gave up repeated explosive plays in the passing game, and Trey McBride dominated the session. All of those issues proved to be harbingers for the season. This year's joint practice should be especially fun, as it's going to pit Mike LaFleur against his brother, Matt LaFleur, who is the Packers' head coach. Plus, former Cardinals head coach Jonathan Gannon is now the defensive coordinator in Green Bay. And then there's cut day. The NFL moved its cut day forward this season, meaning that teams must now trim their rosters to 53 players by Sunday, August 30th. And that's just 2 days after the Cardinals' preseason finale. In addition to the requisite cuts, that day also typically features a flurry of minor trades as teams find new homes for players who could otherwise be released. The ensuing days, meanwhile, can be an opportunity for rebuilding teams, such as the Cardinals, in order to claim players who narrowly missed out on roster spots elsewhere. But by the end of that week, the Cardinals' Week 1 roster should reach its final form. The team will then take Labor Day weekend off as one final reprieve before returning to practice on Monday, September 7th, ahead of the season opener just 6 days later in Los Angeles. And that was the article, Clocking In. And now for some more articles from the interior of the sports section of the paper. This one's about Diamondbacks baseball. Diamondbacks edge Nats in series opener, written by Nick Pecoro for the Arizona Republic, from Washington. Tim Tawa's bunt trickled down the first base line, unplayable, so good it was as if he had rolled it with his bare hands. Gabriel Moreno drove a fly ball to left field, delivering just the kind of at-bat the situation warranted. And in the end, Paul Sewald pumped his fist, tapped his glove, and let out a celebratory expletive. The Diamondbacks won again, this time just 3-2, over the Washington Nationals on Friday, July 24th. As they did so by getting contributions large and small from a variety of sources. In winning for the ninth time in their past 11 games and continuing their charge forward in the National League wildcard race, they have begun to shift the conversation as they approach the trade deadline. 2 weeks ago, the question was whether the Diamondbacks should buy or sell. After they improved their record to 55-49, moving to 6 games over .500 for the first time since late May, it's not whether, but rather what they should buy. That is, of course, barring a disastrous turn of events on this 10-game road trip, a four-city jaunt that has started with back-to-back wins. The Diamondbacks are in sole possession of the third and final wild card spot and are just 1.5 games behind the Philadelphia Phillies for the second wild card. Though their offense has begun to come to life in recent weeks, though they won less thanks to their slug, and more because of their hitters' situational prowess and their pitching. The Diamondbacks put down back-to-back bunts, one for a sacrifice, the other for a run-scoring single by Tawa on a safety squeeze to help generate 2 runs in the second inning. And they got that go-ahead sacrifice fly from Gabriel Moreno to move in front in the 7th inning. Moreno said, quote, "Everybody on the roster recognizes who they are and what the team needs. I know we all want to do our job. Sometimes we have to go out and move the runner, and that's what we've been doing. Executing those plays and scoring runs," unquote. Diamondbacks lefty Eduardo Rodriguez threw 6 innings of 2-run ball, and the bullpen worked 3 perfect innings, including the 9th inning from closer Paul Sewald, who bounced back from a blown save earlier in the week. Right-hander Juan Murillo worked the 7th inning, Kevin Ginkle the 8th inning, and then handed off to Sewald, who got a strikeout, a flyout, and a ground ball to seal the win. That fly ball off the bat of Luis Garcia Jr. was hit hard, but it was also hit high, and it might have been knocked down by the wind. The Diamondbacks are looking to add before the deadline, but they will be dealing with some complicating factors. With their franchise record payroll, they are less than $10 million away from the first luxury tax threshold. They do not seem willing to blow past it, meaning that some trade possibilities will not be realistic options unless their trading partner pays down the salary. So with so few potential sellers, the cost to acquire talent could be higher than usual, raising the question of how much young talent the Diamondbacks are going to want to surrender to upgrade their team. It could mean they have to focus their attention on one area of the roster, like an upgrade at first base or designated hitter, or help on the pitching staff, rather than addressing multiple deficiencies. Now, another consideration is, the club has 8 players, 3 position players, and 5 pitchers, trending toward possible returns in the coming months. The Diamondbacks will want to be sure the players they acquire via the trade are better than those they already have who are on the mend. They are certainly more desirable questions for General Manager Mike Hazen and his staff to consider compared to last year when they were forced to sell as their team stumbled into the deadline. But this year's team seems to be doing the opposite. Though the Diamondbacks still have 2 games left against the Nationals before 3-game sets against the Pirates and the Guardians, both of which who are contending clubs. But manager Torey Lovullo said of this road trip, quote, "So far, so good. We've got a long way to go," unquote. And that was Diamondbacks edge Nats in series opener. Our next article in the sports section is entitled "Cup Series Returns to Battle at Brickyard," written by Zion Brown for the Indianapolis Star. The Brickyard 400, returns to Indianapolis Motor Speedway this weekend for the third year since NASCAR returned to the track's oval. Bubba Wallace is the reigning winner of the 160-lap race after Kyle Larson won it in 2024. Ahead of the race, Indy star caught up with North Central grad Adam Alexander, who is in his second season as the voice of the NASCAR Cup Series on TNT. IMS is again the site of the championship round of NASCAR's In-Season Challenge, which began last year. Created by driver and team owner Denny Hemlin, the In-Season Challenge puts the top 32 drivers in the standings in a five-race, one-on-one bracket, with number one up against number 32 and so on. It rewards $1 million to the last driver standing. The tournament is akin to the NBA's annual NBA Cup, the mid-season tournament that began in 2023. So for five races throughout the 26-race regular season, drivers can race not only for overall points and wins, but they can work toward the prize money for themselves and the team. Alexander said, quote, "I think it's great because I feel like it's something that all sports fans can relate to. Certainly as we come to Indiana this weekend and knowing the power of basketball in that state," unquote. Ryan Blaney and Todd Gilliland have advanced to the championship round in a David versus Goliath situation. It's no surprise that Blaney, the 2023 Cup Series champion, who won at Atlanta Motor Speedway on July 12th, has made it this far in his Team Penske Ford. On the other hand, Gilliland has never won a cup race and entered the in-season challenge as the number 25 seed. An eighth-place finish in the Window World 450 to outdo Chase Elliott in 17th advanced Gilliland to the championship. And Gilliland, who recently signed a contract extension with Front Row Motorsports, finished sixth in each of the last two Brickyard 400s. Blaney finished seventh last year and third in 2024. Alexander said, quote, "There's no doubt Ryan Blaney is the favorite, and if he were to put money on the guy that's going to take home the $1 million, Blaney would be the guy. But I feel like this is a sneaky good matchup as we get to the final this weekend," unquote. Now Hamlin, who drives the number 11 Joe Gibbs Racing Toyota while co-owning 23 Xite Racing with Michael Jordan, is the odds-on favorite to win the race. Hamlin has four wins this year and is first in the Cup Series standings. He plans to retire after the 2027 season. He's never won a Cup championship, nor has the 45-year-old won the Brickyard 400. And that's the article, Cup Series Returns to Battle at Brickyard. We're at 33 minutes past the hour. We're time for us to move on over to the viewpoint section of the paper and read some opinions. Our first opinion piece is entitled, Behind a Fence, a Neighborhood Found Itself. Our park had disappeared. When Sweetwater Park in Phoenix closed for renovation, 19 acres vanished behind chain-link fencing overnight. Well, not literally, of course. The trees were still there. The sprinklers continued their familiar rhythm across the grass. Birds flew over the new 6-foot chain-link fence without giving it a second thought. And the coyotes still slipped through the opening between the park and the school as though nothing had changed. The only ones locked out were the people. For years, Phoenix Parks and Recreation had talked about improving the park. Every few months, someone would mention that construction was about to begin. Like so many neighborhood rumors, it became something we talked about without ever believing it would happen. And then, one morning, 19 acres disappeared behind chain-link fencing. I knew I would miss my daily walk. I knew my dog, M, would need another place to stretch her 22-inch long legs. But what surprised me was how much I missed the people. Within hours, text messages began flying among the regular dog walkers. Has anyone found another place to walk? Maybe the canal. What about the park on Hayden Road? Well, at first, I thought we were searching for another park. But eventually, I realized we were searching for one another. A few days later, I met a man walking his pug, whom I recognized by sight, but had never really spoken with. We stood looking through the fence before he asked the same question that had been rattling around in my head. Quote, couldn't they just close the section they're working on and leave the rest of the park open? And I smiled and said, I've been wondering the same thing. Maybe there are safety or construction reasons that make that impossible. And if so, I would generally like to understand them. But it also makes me wonder whether, on a project expected to last many months, that there might be opportunities to phase the work so that a portion of the neighborhood park could remain open. Because parks are more than open space. They are where ordinary relationships take root. They are where someone notices your aging dog is walking a little slower. Where a newcomer is welcomed without ceremony. Where neighbors become friends through hundreds of brief conversations that by themselves seem unremarkable, but over time, those moments quietly weave a community together. When the fence went up, the community did not disappear. It adapted. Someone hosted a backyard playdate. Another suggested meeting for coffee after an early walk. A friend invited us over to see her remodeled kitchen while serving the latest cake that she had mastered. We still haven't found another park that feels like ours, but we have continued finding one another. The dogs, of course, adjusted almost immediately. It's the humans who were taking a little longer. As construction continues, I'm sure we will eventually discover another trail, another patch of grass, another place to throw a tennis ball. But I hope this experience also raises a broader question. When improvements to a neighborhood park take months or even a year, is there a way to complete the work in phases, allowing people to safely use portions that aren't under construction? If there is, perhaps we preserve more than a walking path. Perhaps we preserve the quiet connections that make a neighborhood feel like home. And that was Behind a Fence, A Neighborhood Found Itself. It was written by Patricia Berry. She's a Phoenix artist, photographer, and writer. And she is completing Mornings at the Park, a collection of essays that explore community, dogs, and the ordinary moments that quietly shape our lives. Our next opinion piece is entitled, Want Less Politics in Arizona Classrooms? Try Primary Sources. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. Now, we all recognize this as the opening line of Charles Dickens' A Tale of Two Cities. But do we know why it was the best and the worst of times? Aren't these mutually contradictory? Or is this a paradox that only a brilliant author like Dickens could unfurl? It's no revelation that many of our schools and teachers have become politicized, as illustrated by shutting down schools and marching on the state capitol during school days, and delaying reopening schools when it was proven safe to do so, or coordinating with a local reporter to defeat Arizona legislation, and accepting $6.5 million from the National Teachers Union to harm a local Arizona school choice program. So, where does one even begin to start building trust with parents once again? Those same parents who have grown increasingly skeptical that their local school district is even teaching the basics. Well, one significant way to help depoliticize the classroom is for schools to insist upon teachers teaching through primary sources. Those are texts written by eyewitnesses during the events they describe. This is not limited to history class. We should even be teaching math through primary sources, although that's an entire column for another day. It's no revelation that district schools are losing students like a sieve and that districts are shutting down entire schools throughout Arizona, all the way from Scottsdale to Peoria. One of the ways to help pressure parents, reassure your parents that your school is teaching the three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic, is the insistence upon primary sources. Since seeking to understand what was written at the time is a way to teach without injecting bias. When I taught humane letters, which consist of literature and history, I had a no politics rule in my classroom. Two of my more loquacious students really wanted to know my opinions on the politics of the day. I always gave them a similar response. Quote, if you could tell me how discussing the recent actions by President Trump will help us to better understand Aristotle's ethics, or whatever the other text is before us, then I'm in. Unquote. Well, after a few times of this, they finally said, okay, Mr. Boyer, we'll focus on the text. Of course, we did discuss politics, that is, 16th century England and 18th century France in particular, as viewed through the eyes of those who witnessed it. Giving students the ability to see human nature in all its glory and fallenness, how human nature really hasn't changed, and how many of our predecessors struggled with the very same things we struggle with, it has a balm-like effect by being far enough removed from today's political disputes. Discussing contemporary politics doesn't provide enough time and reflection to consider it with a cool head. And more often than not, it leads to a desire to win the argument rather than to understand what or how or why something happened. And this, of course, means reading through and discussing difficult text. It's also no revelation that many of our students struggle with reading challenging text, some with just reading at all. Teachers face many challenges, with the challenge for focused attention probably the greatest. But we as teachers also have to give them something compelling to read and discuss. For example, in Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, what is more important, nature or nurture? The creature would no doubt argue for nurture, and if only he wasn't rejected by his creator, he would not have gone on a killing spree of those closest to his maker. But further, what does it mean to be human? I can think of no better text for students to wrestle with this question than Frankenstein. Given where we currently are with artificial intelligence, such a discussion could not be more timely. As C.S. Lewis wrote in his Experiment in Criticism, quote, literary experience heals the wound without undermining the privilege of individuality. In reading great literature, I become a thousand men and yet remain myself. Like the night sky in the Greek poem, I see with a myriad eyes, but it is still I who see. Here, as in worship, in love, in moral action, and in knowing, I transcend myself, and I am never more myself than when I do. Unquote. Seeing students with their noses in great books is much more satisfying than seeing their noses glued to their cell phones. Let's at least give them that. And that was the opinion piece, Want Less Politics in Arizona Classrooms? Try Primary Sources. This was written by Paul Boyer. Now, Paul represented Glendale and North Phoenix in the Arizona legislature from 2013 to 2023. He was a 2021 Arizonan of the Year, and he teaches Greek and Latin. Well, we've got a minute or so left in this time for this section of the paper. Let's read some opinion pieces by people like you and me in the Letters to the Editor. Here's the first one. Regarding Arizona ESA reform initiatives, Arizona's Empowerment Scholarship Accounts, the ESA, allow parents to use public education money for private schools or homeschooling. Since the program expansion in 2022, more than 100,000 students have chosen ESA learning. The existing ESA program does not require private school or homeschool students to take standardized tests. Over the past year, there have been proposals for ESA reform initiatives to require testing for ESA students. Two of the benefits of standardized tests include quantifying the performance of the school and identifying students behind needing additional help. In public schools, testing is done at the start and end of the year. Testing helps schools determine if students are learning the required material. For grades 1 through 4, testing is very important. If the students do not learn the basics of phonics, spelling, reading fluency, and elementary mathematics, they will struggle in the upper grades of 5 through 8. There are many good charter schools in Arizona. Some of the highest scoring schools in Arizona are charter schools. If testing helps identify areas for improvement, why are ESA schools objecting to testing? There is no need for ballot proposals. Arizona ESA schools should require the same testing as public schools. Signed, Bill File from Ahwatukee. And we're at 46 minutes past the hour. We'd better get on over to the entertainment section and begin by reading today's horoscopes. So we will begin with Aries, birth dates from March 21st to April 19th. Are you ready for a personal audit? You are accountable for how you have been presenting yourself. For Taurus, birth dates from April 20th to May 20th, an inward review now begins. Examine hidden patterns, fears, and unfinished emotional business that comes up. For Geminis, birth dates from May 21st to June 21st, are your priorities supporting who you want to be in 10 years' time? For Cancer, birth dates from June 22nd through July 22nd. Preparation is more important than eventual success, so rethink your process. For Leos, birth dates from July 23rd through August 22nd, an outdated belief may be the roadblock on your path. For you fellow Virgos out there, birth dates from August 23rd through September 22nd, is there a trust or money issue that you have been avoiding? Have an honest look at the resistance. For Libras, September 23rd through October 23rd birth dates, close relationships enter a reflective phase today. Where do you need to reassess? For Scorpios, October 24th through November 21st birth dates, simplify your life, review your routines and duties. Are they working for you? For Sagittarius, November 22nd through December 21st birth dates, do you feel fulfilled in your romantic life and creative expression? Happiness is worth working for. For Capricorns, December 22nd through January 19th birth dates, limitations may make themselves apparent in your domestic world. Your foundation is up for review. Be patient. For Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th birth dates, you are seeing the glass as half empty. Be patient with these perceptions. And finally, Pisces, birth dates from February 19th to March 20th. What is a responsible use of your resources? Issues of money and long-term security may arise. And that was today's horoscopes. We turn now to letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren. The first letter goes like this. Dear Abby, my unpleasant older sister lives by the creed, it's my way or the highway. As a result, she has no close friends, no husband or partner, no social circle. She was strongly encouraged to take early retirement from teaching because she could not get along with her co-workers. After retirement, she joined a few clubs but soon quit because they didn't do things right, also known as her way. Even though she treats me terribly, I have tried for years to be the better person and invite her to my family gatherings so she doesn't have to spend holidays alone. Unfortunately, she is also the world's worst house guest. Within minutes of arriving, she announces a list of things she just can't stand and are therefore prohibited during her stay. These include certain TV shows, music, foods, ingredients, topics of conversation, any family story that includes her, etc. She stays until everyone is gone and then berates me for everything that I did wrong during her visit. If I don't invite her, I feel guilty that she's alone and has no other options. If I do invite her, I'm so stressed that I don't get to enjoy having time with my children and grandchildren, which is very precious to me. What do you recommend I do? Signed, Torn Sister in Washington. And Abigail responds, Dear Sister, I think you have suffered enough. If you decide to invite your older sister to visit again, first establish some ground rules. The first should be that when she's under your roof, you, not she, will decide on what entertainment is appropriate and what foods you will serve and how they're prepared. No topic of discussion will be off limits. If there is something she can't eat, she can refuse it. If something being talked about is not to her liking, she's free to leave the room. The second ground rule should be that you are not obligated to entertain her 24/7, particularly if you want to spend time with the grandchildren. Of course, she is free to reject your kind invitation, but if she accepts your conditions, the holiday will be a far happier one for you. The next letter goes like this. Dear Abby, my husband passed away last year. I live by myself in a two-story house with three bedrooms and three bathrooms. My kids want me to sell it. I don't care for the stairs, but that's the only thing I don't like about my house. I've lived in this house for more than 30 years, and I don't want to sell. I've always done what everybody else, especially my husband, has told me to do. For once in my life, I want to do what I want to do. Can you give me some advice? Signed, Finally Free. And Abigail responds this way, Dear Free, my advice is to take your own advice. You seem to be happy where you are, so don't allow your kids to pressure you into selling before you are ready. I will add, though, that it would be wise to run your kids' worries by your physician. If there are health concerns that make it unsafe for you to live alone in a big house with stairs, it's best to listen to your doctor. And those were the letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren. You can contact Abigail in two different ways. You can go to her website, www.dearabby.com, or you can write her a letter and mail it to P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, zip code 90069. And those were the letters of advice. Well, we have time to look at some comics from the Sunday's Funny Papers. The first one is Beetle Bailey, drawn by Greg Bryan and Neil Walker. In the first frame, there's Sergeant Snorkel standing next to Lieutenant Fuzz. Lieutenant Fuzz is in front of his laptop. And Lieutenant Fuzz says, I'm using artificial intelligence to generate a report for the general. And then he says to the computer, make an inventory of all current supplies. Suggest ways we can make the system more efficient. Recommend a set of conclusions and print. And in the last frame, he's standing in front of General Halftrack. He's holding out a report that, oh, looks like it's about 4 or 5 inches thick. And he goes, all done, sir. And the general says, go back and tell AI I want brevity. And that was Beetle Bailey. And then in Blondie, drawn by Dean Young and John Marshall, Dagwood's picked up the phone and hears from the phone, cough, cough. Hey, Dag, I'm cough. And Dagwood says, Herb, are you okay, buddy? And he hangs up the phone. Oh, my gosh, my best pal is in trouble. I better get over there on the double. And he races out the door, front door. I'm on my way, partner. Hang on, amigo. And he gets over to Herb's house and he grabs his shoulders and says, what's wrong, Herb? You sounded like you were in dire straits. And Herb says, I sure am. I'm cooking hamburgers on the grill, and I need onions. Onions? You're grilling hamburgers and you didn't think of calling me? Well, obviously I did. So, do you have any onions or not? And that was Blondie. And in the comic strip Baby Blues, drawn by Rick Kirkman and Jerry Scott, in the top frame, we see Zoe and Hammy sitting in the chairs, and poke and stab. And then they each sniff the straw, and then they take a big sip of the straw, and then they swish, swish, swish the stuff around in their mouth. And then Zoe says, "I'm getting papaya with hints of high fructose corn syrup." And Hammy says, yes, fruit forward, smack, smack, with hints of citric acid and red food coloring. And then Zoe says, "All in all, an excellent fruit punch." And Hammy says, "It should pair well with peanut butter and jelly." As Dad approaches the table with plates with peanut butters and jelly sandwiches on them, and he turns to his wife and says, "No more Food Channel for these two." And that was Baby Blues. Well, before we go, we ought to wish happy birthday to some celebrities. Looks like Mick Jagger is turning 83 today. Actress Helen Mirren's turning 81. Kevin Spacey, the actor, is turning 67. Sandra Bullock is turning 62. Jeremy Piven, 61. Jason Statham is turning 59. Kate Beckinsale is turning 53. And Monica Raymond is turning 40. Congratulations and happy birthday. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. You have been listening to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, July 26th, 2026. Have a great day.